This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear about efforts to get rid of that pesky math requirement, algebra, in high schools. Some say there are better alternatives. We'll check in at the State House to get an update on the big issues facing lawmakers as the spring legislative session winds down. Soybean farmers are nervous about the trade war with China. We'll hear from them, and we'll learn about a deadly race riot in Illinois. It happened 100 years ago. The columnist George Will, an Illinois native, came back to be honored this past week with the Order of Lincoln.
The Midwest begins on the western slope of the Alleghenies and stretches to the eastern slope of the Rockies, but the heart of the matter is the Mississippi Valley, and the beating heart of the Mississippi Valley is the great state of Illinois.
That and more coming up on this episode of Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll get an update on where things stand at the State House, just days away from the scheduled end of the legislature's spring session. A lot of key issues still on the table. Have you ever been part of an escape room? They're becoming more popular. We'll have a report on that. And we recall a deadly race riot in Illinois. It happened 100 years ago. That and more on today's Statewide. This past week, six people from Illinois were awarded the Order of Lincoln. It's the state's highest honor for professional accomplishments in public service, and one of those singled out, columnist George Will, a Champaign native born and raised there. Today on Statewide, we thought we'd share some of what George Will had to say after being honored. He spoke in Springfield and talked about two of the topics near and dear to his heart, Abraham Lincoln and baseball. Here's George Will.
I cannot tell you adequately how much this award means to me. I've not lived in the state of Illinois since September 1958, when 4 months past my 17th birthday, I went away to college. I have never, however, not once ever, thought of myself as other than a son of the prairies of Illinois, a son of the American middle border, to which it is always a delight to return. The introducer gave away my dark secret that I only write about politics and governance to support my baseball habit, which I acquired in Illinois, in Champaign, in Little League, playing for the Mittendorf Funeral Home Panthers. Our color was black. I also, in Jerry's presence here, I should say that I too was a basketball star of sorts. I played for the University of Illinois Education Department Laboratory High School, known as Uni High, or because of our athletic attainments, known as Puny Uni. My senior year, our record was 2 wins and 18 losses, and the school we beat twice consolidated that winter, probably from embarrassment. Remarkable thing about the state of Illinois is that it is the beating heart of the country. The Midwest begins on the western slope of the Alleghenies and stretches to the eastern slope of the Rockies, but the heart of the matter is the Mississippi Valley, and the beating heart of the Mississippi Valley is the great state of Illinois. People don't quite realize how exemplary and special the state is. The northern tip of Illinois is north of Cape Cod. The southern tip of Illinois is south of Richmond. So it unites the country east and west, north and south, in a way that no other state does. And to grow up in central Illinois, as I did, and I can think of no greater blessing, is to be marinated in the spirit and presence of Abraham Lincoln. According to local lore, the Red Indiana Sandstone Courthouse on the Courthouse Square in Urbana, Illinois, in the Twin Cities, was where Lincoln was in 1854 when he learned that another son of Illinois, Stephen A. Douglas, had successfully passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act. It was Lincoln's recoil against the Kansas-Nebraska Act that ignited his career, the greatest career in my judgment, in the history of world governance. The Kansas-Nebraska Act said, well, all right, on the fraught question of the expansion of slavery into the territories, we'll leave it up to the territories. We'll submit it to a vote. Popular sovereignty in the territories will settle the issue. Lincoln, in his implacable, canny, unwavering resistance to this doctrine, said no. Majority rule is all right for many things, but it is, we do not submit fundamental human rights to votes of majorities. And from this, he took off into what was one of the greatest careers the world has ever seen. The career began in this town in a sense that this man whose oratory is still quoted made his first great and memorable speech in this town at the Young Men's Lyceum at age of 29 in 1838, when he worried that the passing of all the veterans and the memories of the Revolution and the cost it took to found this country meant that our national memory was being destroyed by, and this was the first great Lincoln phrase inserted into our civic vocabulary, was being destroyed by, he said, the silent artillery of time. Lincoln would have none of it. His career was to reconnect us with the founders. In 1859, on the eve of the Civil War, with disunion clouds lowering over the country, he addressed a crowd at the Wisconsin Agricultural Society, a precursor of the state fair. In this address, he told the story of an Oriental despot who summoned his wise men and gave them an assignment. He said, I want you to go away and don't return until you have devised a proposition to be carved in stone, to be forever in view and forever true. Some weeks later, the wise men returned, and the proposition they had presented to the despot was, this too shall pass away. How consoling, Lincoln said, in times of grief, how chastening in times of pride. But it need not be true, said Lincoln. He said, if we cultivate the moral and intellectual world within us as prodigiously and assiduously as we cultivate the physical world around us, the United States and all that it stands for shall not pass away. And so it has been, and so it is the mission given to all of us by Abraham Lincoln is to make sure that the silent artillery of time does not allow any of the great fundamental principles to pass away. Lincoln gives us a timeless model of excellence, chastening in its excellence, but inspiring too. I can't speak for this long without a baseball story, so I will link it to that. In the early 1920s, there was the greatest right-handed hitter in the history of baseball, Rogers Hornsby, was at the plate. And there was a rookie pitcher on the mound who was quite understandably petrified. And he threw three pitches that he thought were strikes, and the umpire said, ball one, ball two, ball three. The rookie got flustered and shouted into the umpire, said, umpire, those were strikes. The umpire took off his mask, looked out at the picture, and said, young man, when you throw a strike, Mr. Hornsby will let you know. Hornsby had become the standard of excellence. It's an American aspiration for all of us. And there is no more vivid example of American excellence than Abraham Lincoln. And all of us who are privileged to be inducted in this ceremony into the company, as it were, of Abraham Lincoln are duly chastened and duly inspired. And again, I thank you so much for this. I'm the last of your laureate speeches for which you can sigh with relief. You're probably feeling a little bit the way Jeff Torborg did when he was managing the White Sox. He went out one day to take a pitcher out of the game, Jimmy Kern. And he got to the mound and Kern said, Skipper, I'm not tired. And Torborg said, Jimmy, we know you're not tired, but our outfielders are. So none of us will ever tire of being associated now forever with the beating heart of Illinois, which is the spirit of Abraham Lincoln. Again, I thank you very much.
Columnist George Will speaking in Springfield last week after receiving the Order of Lincoln. He was one of several to be honored. Others included Ed Curtis, the president and CEO of Memorial Health System in Springfield and a member of the SIU Board of Trustees, former Illinois Supreme Court Justice Ben Miller, Black Entertainment Television co-founder Sheila Crump Johnson, the cancer researcher Dr. Lufunmileo Lopade, and the former U of I and Chicago Bulls basketball player and sports team owner Jerry Colangelo. The Order of Lincoln, the state's highest honor, has been around for over 50 years. Now let's take a look back. 1919 proved to be a violent year in the U.S. Race riots flared up across the country. But today, some of those events seem lost to history. An Illinois-based author is shining a light on one of the riots, hoping it helps Americans avoid repeating past mistakes. Rich Egger reports.
The book's title is A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. 38 people were killed in that violence, hundreds more were injured, and the rioters caused more than $1 million damage. The book's author is Claire Hartfield of Chicago. Hartfield writes for young audiences, but she believes this book will also interest adults.
I think that young people learn a lot from the experience and the worldview of their mentors, whether it's their parents or their teachers or some other adult. And so I wrote the book as an partly as an opportunity for young and adult people to read it and then have discussions about the issues and talk to each other about each of their individual perspectives.
Are you finding even adults are learning something new? I grew up in the Chicago area, and until recently, I was not aware of the Chicago race riot of 1919.
Well, you are not alone. What I am finding, I'm going all over the place doing presentations, and I also run into people on the street, mostly who I know, but others as well, who say, I read your book, and I absolutely never knew about this riot. And they're very grateful that they now know about it, and it gives them perspective, both on, if they're Chicagoans, on the city that they grew up in or the city that they live in, but also more nationally, since many of the issues resonate with what we're going through today on a national scale, it really helps to give some perspective to what we're going through today.
Why do you suppose so many people had never heard of this riot?
I've thought about that, and I don't have a definitive answer. One thing I think is that, of course, the media that we had back then was much more limited. And when I think about all of the videos that we have, for example, from TV footage of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, I remember when I was younger and still today seeing video footage of that on TV or in school. And so that made me aware of that. So I think that's one piece of it, is there's just not visual image other than archival photos, and those just don't get around as much. There is some stuff on the internet about it, but it certainly doesn't have the technological visual that we're used to seeing nowadays. And then the other thing is that I think that period around World War I is not as well known to people today, particularly to young people, but also to adults, as say time after World War II. I think that's what most people are aware of.
What lesson can we learn today from what happened 100 years ago in Chicago?
Well, this is interestingly where Carl Sandburg comes in for me. So Carl Sandburg was actually living in Chicago at that time, and he covered the race riots in a series of articles for the Chicago Daily News. And those articles have been put together into a book. And so that was one of the books that I looked at, and I read these articles when I was doing my research. And it caused me to become much more curious about him, and I started looking through some of his poems. And I found this one poem called I Am the People, the Mob, which was actually written several years before the riot. But it was so prescient in terms of predicting or, you know, what might happen, seeing these tensions and what can happen from them. And what he says in the poem is there are all these masses of working class people who are taking, who are the backbone of our country and who are laboring so very hard and not being heard and not, you know, and living really challenging lives. And that every once in a while, they rise up and spatter a few red drops for history to remember, and then they forget. So it's this cycle of complacency and then convulsion and then complacency and then convulsion, because we don't remember and learn from our history in a way that we could. And at the end of the poem, he is much more hopeful in a way, and he says, "When I, the people, learn to remember, then things will be better." And so that really struck me as really what I was trying to get at in the book, is that we don't have to continue to go through this cycle. If we acknowledge our history, we look it in the face, and we talk and work together about how we can do it differently going forward. And so the book is called A Few Red Drops, and that line is taken directly from the Carl Sandburg poem.
Claire Hartfield is author of A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. She says the violence in Chicago was one of 25 riots across the U.S. that summer, which she said has become known as the Red Summer because of all the bloodshed.
That's Rich Egger with that interview here on Statewide. Coming up, we've heard about a busy agenda this spring at the Illinois State House, but what will get done before time runs out? We'll get an update just ahead. Back on Statewide, I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, what does the ongoing trade war mean for soybean farmers right here in the Midwest? And we'll remember a longtime journalist who passed away this week, right after writing his final column. More on Chuck Sweeney. That's on the way.
I'm Daisy Contreras with NPR Illinois. With just a little bit over a week left into the spring legislative session, there are many issues lawmakers have yet to settle. Meeting at the state capitol, I'm joined by the team of NPR Illinois reporters who have been looking into these issues. Dusty Rhodes, Mary Hansen, Jacqueline Driscoll, and Brian Mackey. Everyone, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Good to be with you.
Brian, we'll start with you. You've been following some of the budget negotiations. What's new?
Well, what's new is, I guess, not that new. The Republicans are saying that they're being excluded from the process, or they're worried about being excluded from the process. Democrats say they want to take time and make sure things are done right. But it's all being helped along by some relatively good budget news we got a couple of weeks ago, which is the so-called April surprise. $1.5 billion of extra money that was paid in taxes in April for the current year coming in. So it's still relatively early in the budget process, but they keep negotiating. Democrats say they hope it will be a bipartisan budget. Republicans say they hope so too, but they're a little more skeptical, of course, being in the super minority in both the House and Senate.
And Dusty, you've been covering several plans about education. Teacher licensure has been a big issue on your beat. What's happening with those?
Yeah, it's important because it plays so directly into the teacher shortage. So there's a couple of big bills that would address licensure, and you know, not surprisingly, they're both sponsored by legislators who were school teachers. So one of them is Representative Sue Scher of Decatur, and her bill would suspend what's called the basic skills test for about 6 years. It would suspend that requirement for about 6 years to allow the Illinois State Board of Education to kind of reevaluate the situation. That test has kept a lot of potential teachers out of the pipeline, especially minorities.
And Mary, another issue has been infrastructure. What's the latest?
So there are several proposals, plans floating around. Senators and representatives have been negotiating their own plans, and the governor announced his $41.5 billion proposal last week, which includes both roads and bridges, that horizontal piece, as well as the vertical, the buildings and state facilities. Lawmakers have been hearing from just about everybody in the last couple of months about what they need in an infrastructure bill. So mayors and county engineers and business folks saying they need to fix the roads. And then you also have colleges and universities and elementary schools, high schools, all of them saying they have billions in backlogged maintenance.
And Jacqueline, the marijuana legalization proposal is still under heavy construction.
When we saw the bill language unveiled just a couple weeks ago, that was something that the sponsors, the governor, said that this was still a work in progress. It wasn't the final bill. This wasn't the, you know, we hadn't seen the last of the changes. It was just basically getting the language out and allowing negotiations to take place in the public eye. There was a Senate committee last week on the proposal where they were able to kind of flesh out some of the details in the bill. We were able to hear more from the Republicans about some of their concerns, a couple of those that we will watch for changes to come in the very near future. And Daisy, you have been covering the topic of gambling expansion throughout the state. What are the odds we'll see a bill pass before the end of May?
I've been focusing on sports betting, and as of the taping of this conversation, we are still waiting on final language. We've seen several proposals over the last month, taking into consideration many concerns from various groups, including the casino industry, video gaming, and those who are worried about gambling addiction. And I think that's something that we should be looking out for is if sports wagering will become a part of a larger gambling expansion plan, which would include more casino licenses and an increase in video gaming taxes. Thanks, everyone, for joining me today.
Thank
you. Good to talk to you, Daisy.
Thanks, Daisy.
That's our State House reporting team giving us an update here on Statewide. You can read more of what they have to say about some of those key issues. A link is at our website, statewideshow.com. Escape rooms have become quite popular. These are games where a group of people have to find clues and solve puzzles before time runs out. They're actually more popular than ever, with just a handful in existence in 2015 to now more than 2,300 nationwide. Jonathan All reports they've become such a big thing, they're now opening in smaller cities.
Four women are entering a room at Great Escape in a small warehouse in Rolla. The scenario is they're detectives in 1920s New York. There have been three murders, and the killer will commit another in an hour. All the clues needed to thwart the crime are in this room. Cynthia Brookshire is one of the owners and operators of this escape room business. She's giving some instructions to the players about an old typewriter they may need to use.
And I will even tell you, it is old, and the space bar, you need to help it down and help it up as well.
Okay.
It's old, like an old detective would have in his office. He's limping along with what he's got.
And sure enough, they need the old machine to help solve a puzzle and get a clue.
B-G-R-F-F-Space.
Great Escape in Rolla is typical of small market escape rooms. The room is sparse. The furniture is from thrift stores. The clues are homemade. But Brookshire says her four-month-old business is already doing well in introducing people in the Rolla area to escape games, albeit on a limited budget, without Hollywood-type production values.
They're very basic. They're just locks and keys and puzzles and clues and not really any gadgets. As a business, as we get into it, then we will, when we change things out and add things, we will advance up the line and have more gadgets and more tech.
Brookshire says the technology and production values of her escape rooms will grow along with the customers in Rolla. Jay Kays is the general manager of Escape the Room in St. Louis. It's a national company with 19 locations. He says he likes it when customers who started at mom and pop rooms come to his location.
One of my favorite reactions is when they come here and they played other places and they see our production value here. It really blows people away in terms of what an escape room can and in our opinion should be.
One of Escape the Room's games is Western Bank Heist, where players try to rob a bank and escape without detection. And the room looks, feels, and smells like an Old West bank, from the aged woodwork to the massive old-timey safe. Case says the company spends what it needs to spend to make the room feel realistic.
Like, the safe that we have in here is a really expensive safe, and we chose that safe because it's the best safe that looks for this. So we're not really limited by cost. It's more the right thing for the right room.
Kay says it costs the company up to $100,000 to create a room like this. Big city escape rooms will always have bigger budgets because there are more potential customers nearby. But small market escape rooms can be more than just starter experiences that lead people to bigger city rooms. That's according to David and Lisa Spira, who run the blog Room Escape Artist. They have played more than 700 rooms around the country. David says they've played small market locations that have been innovative and fun.
An immersive adventure, you can produce all sorts of different environments. Maybe you won't produce a crazy, elaborate, ancient Egyptian tomb. Maybe you'll make something that's a little bit more modern and a little bit more attainable if you're serving a smaller audience. But you can still make an immersive adventure nonetheless.
David and Lisa say they've played rooms with very good production values that weren't very fun because the puzzles, clues, and gameplay weren't very good. While the number of escape rooms continues to grow, there is a sign it may slow down. Google Trends shows searches for escape rooms are down about 30% compared to a year ago. I'm Jonathan All.
A Rockford media icon has passed away. The Rockford Register Star columnist and political reporter Chuck Sweeney died in his home on Monday. He was 70. His final column was published just a day later. Susan Stevens has this look back.
Chuck Sweeney hit his deadlines for 35 years at his hometown newspaper, the Rockford Register Star, as a political reporter, as an editor, and as a columnist. His final column touched on some of his favorite issues: trains, transportation, a proposed Piatown airport, and Rockford getting the shaft when it comes to state funding. Register Star opinion editor Wally Haas says Sweeney filed his last column just a few hours before he died. The two had worked together since Sweeney started covering politics for the Register Star in 1984.
You know, he could be a bit curmudgeonly, but he loved Rockford, and that would come through in his writing. You know, he'd poke at public officials and, you know, try to get them to do the right thing. And quite often he succeeded.
Humor, curmudgeon, institutional knowledge. Those are some of the words that keep cropping up in person and on social media as people remember Chuck Sweeney and what he meant to the city of Rockford. Mark Bonney knew Sweeney for decades as a fellow reporter in the Register Star's newsroom, as friends, and most recently through Bonney's work in State Senator Steve Stottleman's office. Bonney says Sweeney was a tough reporter who cultivated that curmudgeonly personality.
But there was really underneath all of that, you know, was actually a guy who really loved Rockford and who really did have a heart.
One of Bonney's favorite memories is when Sweeney came up with a way to cheer up school board member Alice Sedargis, whose husband had died near Christmas. Sweeney decided she needed to be Christmas caroled. They recruited local politicians and media members. Chuck brought his keyboard, and they serenaded Sedargis.
It was really Chuck's idea. I helped him organize it, but it was Chuck's idea. And I don't think most people would think of Chuck in that way.
For a newspaper guy, Sweeney was a familiar face in the Rockford area. The city's local TV news stations frequently called on him as an election night analyst or to chime in on a hot local issue. When Rockford had live talk radio, he was a frequent guest and enjoyed shooting down negative callers by calling them cave people, citizens against virtually everything. He was an active Facebook provocateur, arguing about politics and local issues one minute, then turning around and sharing his family's British history and a favorite recipe for Cornish-style pasties. Sweeney was also an award-winning member of a regular panel of commentators on WNIJ. And then there was the music.
What he was like was brilliant for his ability to improvise. And improvise within pretty much any style you could imagine.
Ron Holm knew Sweeney all of his adult life. They played together in a band called Emery Christensen in the 1970s and 80s. Holm says he's never come across another piano player with the musical range and flexibility of Chuck Sweeney. He also credits Sweeney as the force behind a song that became a bit of a local legend. Sweeney suggested Holm write a song about a truck driver coming home to Rockford and enter it in a local Chamber of Commerce contest. It wound up on a compilation album called Make It in Rockford. Holmes says his current band plays about 150 dates a year. That song is still one of the most requested. Holmes says he'll miss Sweeney as a musician, but also as an independent thinker who challenged his readers to look at issues from different angles.
He had a lot more journalism in him than he had years to live.
Chuck Sweeney is survived by his wife, Shireen, and their two adult children. I'm Susan Stevens.
Many farmers are racing to get their soybeans planted, even as the biggest market for them has nearly dried up. The ongoing trade war with China leaves them especially vulnerable, but as Amy Mayer with Harvest Public Media reports, American farmers have long relied on overseas sales.
Let's look at farm trade in three acts. Act 1, oversupply and politics. Going back at least to the late 19th century, U.S. farmers have sold much of what they've grown abroad. That's according to historian Joe Anderson of Mount Royal University in Calgary. But he says after World War II, a couple of changes set the stage for today's global marketplace.
There's agricultural policy that's part of this. There's technology that's part of this.
Synthetic fertilizer and other advances meant farmers were producing well beyond the domestic demand for crops such as corn and soybeans. And in Washington, lawmakers decided to marry surplus to foreign policy.
In the post-World War II period, the United States started using food and commodities in general as a tool in the Cold War.
Beyond government-directed sales to other countries, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and many commodity groups combined forces to open offices overseas and sponsor trade missions.
Well, the most recent one, I was at Vietnam and the Philippines.
Central Iowa farmer Denny Friest serves on the Iowa Corn Board and has made several trips to Asia.
As a corn grower and a soybean grower and a pork producer, these markets are very key to everything that I need to create demand for the products we grow, because we're in a global economy. We're the low-cost producers of food in the world, and we just need fair access to these markets.
These pigs eat a lot of soybeans, and then some of them get sold abroad. But what happens when demand slumps? That brings us to Act Two. Why do farmers stick with the same crops?
This is where all the technology is.
Farming today takes a lot of capital. As a boy, Friest never rode on a tractor with a cab. But 5 decades into this business, the one on this John Deere is equipped with 4 different monitors. With all he's invested in land, equipment, and technology, he can't just wake up one day and decide to grow something else.
Our soils adapt very well to growing corn. They grow soybeans. We have the markets for them. And we have the machinery set up for it.
So he's dedicated to attracting overseas buyers. In addition to Asian countries, he and other farmers have their eyes on Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. Already this year, the European Union is buying more from the U.S. than it used to. Pekka Pesonen is with the main lobbying voice for EU agriculture.
Imports from the United States increased by 14%, mainly due to soybean imports.
Even though the robust trade relationship between the U.S. and EU has a long history, Pesonen says it's not immune to impacts from the current trade war between the U.S. and China.
It's quite worrying for us because agriculture is usually one of the first casualties of such a dispute, and it quite often is kind of collateral damage.
And many U.S. farmers feel like they're the collateral damage right now. While a second promised bailout could help some, many hope instead for a trade resolution that revives the Chinese market for their products. Now Act 3. China's too big to lose. Chinese demand is huge and still growing, or it was anyway. That's how farmers came to be so focused on it, says Mike Steenhook of the Soy Transportation Coalition.
And that paid off swimmingly for a number of years. And now all of a sudden, due to geopolitical tension, that forecast has changed dramatically.
Meaning until China and the U.S. reach a truce in the trade war, there's going to be a lot of stress in farm country. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. Still to come, should Illinois nix the algebra requirements? More on that on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, maybe you are one of those who struggled with algebra in high school. Is there a better way? Some educators think the state should lift the requirement and instead focus more on topics like personal finance. We'll hear a report that's coming up. And a reminder, we have a website. You can find our stories there and all our past episodes at statewideshow.com. You can also get a podcast of Statewide through the NPR One app. Up next, this spring, President Donald Trump's administration effectively barred transgender individuals from serving in the military. Tatiana Moaton was transitioning from male to female when she joined the Army in 1995, where she served as an intelligence officer until 2003. The Chicago resident told Maureen McKinney about what it was like being a trans soldier and how she feels about the ban, which reversed a 2010 Obama rule.
Wanted to ask if you can tell me about your experience in the military and whether you had transitioned at the time.
Being in the military and being a trans woman in the early stages of transition in the military, I cannot say that I've ever had a negative experience. And that is because our main focus, being in the military and being a service member, has always been our duty to our country first, and everything else comes secondary. So it never became an issue among my individual platoon members. Like I said, even if they knew something was going on, we still had a job to do and a mission to carry out. So that's what we focused on. We never got into who's sleeping with whom and who loves whom and stuff like that. And as I've oftentimes told people in relating my stories about being in the military, it doesn't matter what color, what gender identity, or whom you love. The main thing that matters to us is that we're all in green, or whatever your, you know, your uniform is.
What do you think about the rule change enacted this spring that effectively barred transgender people from serving?
When thinking about this ban that our current president has decided, with, of course, the Supreme Court's backing against trans service members, and some of the main basis of that conversation has been the affecting of unit cohesion. I've never seen that displayed. And unit cohesion is never affected by those things because, again, when you're on those front lines of war or anywhere deployed, none of that stuff matters. You know, all the enemy that we have or I have identified, only thing they see is that you're an American and it's us against them, you know, suffice it to say. And when they talk about the higher cost of medical care, it actually costs more for me as a trans person or any other trans person to suppress who we are. And so I think that it is unfair and it's unjust, particularly when we're living in a climate where violence against trans people is heightened, you know, to come from our federal government. Because I gave 8 years of my life to serve this country. And basically what that translates to me is that I fought for the rights for people to hate me as a trans person. And that is not a good thing to me because I still pay taxes to this country. I still, you know, and I enjoy the benefits of being a honorable served veteran. But those things have basically gone out of the window.
What does it mean to you, this ban?
Now, to think that my unit or, you know, my battalion would be losing that person, you know, me in that role, you know, and I wouldn't be able to provide them with that intelligence. And that's sad. And to think that it's actually quite scary when you think about the entirety of it all.
That's Tatiana Moaton, a transgender individual and a former Army intelligence officer. She spoke with Maureen McKinney. One of the oldest Jewish synagogues in Illinois has closed its doors. Worshippers gathered over the last weekend at B'nai Shalom in Quincy to sanctify the temple. Shayla Farzan has that story.
B'nai Shalom worshippers passed around the sacred Torah scrolls before leaving the temple for the last time Saturday afternoon. The shrinking congregation of about two dozen was forced to close the Quincy Synagogue, which dates back to the late 1860s, after they were unable to pay for its upkeep. Rabbi Justin Kerber said the congregation has not yet decided where to hold future services.
It is like a funeral in that everybody is telling their stories and laughing and enjoying the moment and celebrating the life. And yet that life is over and a new, different life is beginning that nobody quite knows what's going
to
be.
They plan to sell the building and use the proceeds to maintain a nearby cemetery. I'm Shayla Farzan.
Schools across the state are struggling with a teacher shortage. A recent survey finds it's getting worse. What does the shortage actually look like, and what are leaders doing to fix it? From Northern Illinois, Peter Medlin has more on that.
Montmorency is a rural K-8 school district of just around 230 kids in Whiteside County. They've had an opening for a special education teacher for about a month. They've only had 3 teachers apply so far.
We had the special ed position open for 2 weeks before I even had an applicant.
That is Alex Moore. He's the superintendent of Montmorency. He also went to school here. In fact, in his words, he grew up around 2 cornfields away.
And at that point, I was actually seeking out people myself. Yeah, you hate to have to do it, but you have to do a little bit of recruiting. You have to recruit maybe even educators from other districts and sell them on what a smaller district has to offer.
70 miles northeast is Rockford. Their public schools serve just over 28,000 students. They're also struggling to find teachers, especially for positions like special ed. At the beginning of the 2018-19 school year, they had 18 unfilled positions in special ed. That's according to the State Board of Education. Earlier this year, the Illinois Association of Superintendents of Schools released a statewide survey illustrating how the teacher shortage issue has grown worse. 85% of surveyed districts say the shortage has been a problem for them, whether small or large. That's up 6% from last year. Lee County has been especially hard hit. Bob Sangeroth is the regional superintendent of Lee, Ogle, and Whiteside counties. He said it's not just Lee that's struggling, but everyone, and especially rural districts.
There's 2 reasons for it. One is that sometimes their pay is lower. The other thing is that a few years back, probably 5 or 6 years now, the state of Illinois changed the way that they license teachers.
The most openings across education statewide are in special education along with foreign language teachers. Some openings are more surprising, like for art or music teachers. In the past, districts have been shuttering those programs, and prospective teachers were shying away from those fields. Sangras says things are beginning to change, which poses a unique problem.
And so now that we're starting to be able to reinstate those programs, there's no teachers out there.
Matt Zedeker is the chief human resources officer at Rockford Public Schools. He says the same problem exists in big districts like Rockford.
And so, yeah, we're looking at art, music, PE. Those are all, instead of having, 25 applicants per position, we may be only having 10 or 5. Even in general elementary education, where you'd see 80 people apply, we're seeing 20 apply.
Rockford and other more urban districts also face a lack of diversity among teachers. Zedeker says that's a problem that should be talked about more.
Our students of color now are the majority versus, our white students. And to have students maybe go through our system and never have a teacher that looks like them is impactful.
Back in Montmorency, the student population has also changed. But Superintendent Moore says it's not demographics as much as it is sheer numbers.
One of the biggest things that's changed, I can tell you, from the time I was here as a student until now is the number of students. So when I was here, there were 450 students as a child, and now we're at like 230. So you kind of see that mass exodus of Illinois, and we've really seen that.
Sangeroth says the state is starting to take steps to help the situation. He says the new evidence-based funding formula is a good step. Among other things, he'd also like to see testing for incoming teachers overhauled. Alex Moore hopes the state doesn't go through with the $40,000 teacher minimum salary. He says it puts an unfair burden on smaller districts and doesn't consider cost of living variance.
That sounds all great, fine and dandy. But smaller districts like us, that's gonna put a load on us, and we may at some point have to look at ways to cut costs.
Sangeroth is also concerned that the teacher shortage could exacerbate society's already souring perception of teachers.
It seems like the teachers get the blame for everything. Teachers get the blame for the budget crisis because of the pension fund. It's not the teacher's fault that the state legislature didn't make their contribution over the last 30 years or 40 years.
Since Sangeroth's remarks, an anonymous death threat was sent to several Illinois legislators in a public radio station. It threatens anyone who would receive a state pension and says that would include public school teachers. Despite the state's efforts to try and curb the issue, district surveys said they believe the shortage will get worse in the next few years. I'm Peter Medlin.
The school nurse whose split-second decision to use one student's diabetic medication to save another student's life came to the Illinois Capitol this week As we recently reported, Jennifer Jacobs saved a seventh grader who was experiencing a severe hypoglycemic episode by using another student's supply of a hormone that triggers the body to release stored glucose. The decision could have cost Jacobs her nursing license, but she got immediate confirmation from Heather Wingler, the licensed practical nurse who assists her at Glenview Middle School in East Moline.
We each looked at each other, and in our eyes, we knew what the answer was. But we also understood the repercussions of making that decision, and together it just seemed like a no-brainer.
Their decision inspired legislation that will allow public school nurses to provide the life-saving medication. Wingler had Jacobs back again this week. She remained on duty at the school so Jacobs could travel to the State House to see the Senate approve the bill, sending it on to the governor. A proposal to change high school math requirements is working its way through the state legislature, our Dusty Rhodes explains.
Pleasant Plains is a small but prosperous town about 15 minutes northwest of Springfield. Its schools are all rated commendable, and their test results outshine state averages in every subject. And yet in March, the high school principal, Luke Brooks, asked Illinois lawmakers to stop requiring algebra. Here he is testifying before an education committee.
It's the number one failed course in my high school. Most schools around, it's the number one failed course in community colleges.
He said sure, 90% of Pleasant Plains students would still opt for the traditional path of Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2, Pre-Calculus. But what about that kid who just wanted to be a welder and got so frustrated he dropped out?
We scream college and we whisper career. And these kids who want to go into careers and have a skill set, we will give up financial literacy, statistics, construction math, and we basically, for lack of a better term, we just slide that away and say, you must know this, even though most statistics will tell you less than maybe 7% of the working world uses algebra. I just think it's a little disingenuous of a lot of adults to say, you know, this is what human intelligence is.
Representative Katie Stewart, a Democrat from Edwardsville, immediately asked to be listed as chief co-sponsor of his bill, which might seem surprising considering her resume. I met with her later to get her to spell out her credentials.
I have a degree in mathematics from Rutgers University, and then a master's in mathematics from SIU Edwardsville. I also have a certification in mathematics education, which I got at Tulane University in New Orleans.
Stewart also taught math in grades 6 through 12. The Pleasant Plains principal's plea to create a path for non-mathy kids really resonated with her.
We need some other type of course. We need to offer our juniors and seniors more of these applied mathematics, the financial mathematics, or a real in-depth look into probability issues or anything like that, to give them an option as opposed to what we think of as like a traditional pre-calculus course. Because I love trigonometry, but I understand that we don't, your face is what most people.
You seem like such a nice lady.
Yeah. Well, trigonometry really puts the world together if you understand what's going on. But you can understand the world without understanding trigonometry.
In fact, at SIUE, Stewart helped create a course called Quantitative Reasoning to replace the traditional math requirement that stymied so many students. Still, she's unwilling to grant Brooks' wish to get rid of algebra altogether.
I can't see it being responsible and getting rid of any algebra requirement at all. I think it's important. So I'm not willing to just say 3 years of math and carte blanche.
She negotiated an amendment that keeps the Algebra 1 requirement, but allows geometry to be taught as a component of another course like carpentry. Representative Mike Murphy, a Republican from Springfield, filed both the original bill and the amendment. Married to a school teacher who retired after 31 years in the classroom, Murphy obviously has empathy for his constituent, Principal Brooks.
You know, the number one reason kids drop out of college is they can't pass math. 27% of the dropouts, I saw this report online the other day, 27% is because they fail, and math is the number one thing they fail.
But Murphy says he also wants to dig into the broader problem.
One of my plans to do this summer is I want to put together a little study group, task force, or whatever you want to call it, on why are we failing in math? What are we doing as a country? What are we doing as a state? I don't have that answer.
Meanwhile, the amended bill won unanimous approval in the House and is headed for a vote in the full Senate. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
That wraps up another edition of Statewide. We're glad you could be with us. Join us again next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. This episode and past episodes are all available at our website, statewideshow.com. You can also go there and drop us a line. Let us know you're tuned in. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.